Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell, and sitting here with me, as always, and welcome back to my co-host, Hannah Buchdahl.
Hey.
Hannah, welcome.
Hey, Charlie. Good to see you again. Sorry I missed last week.
We did. We took our first week off. Our
first hiatus.
You know, we must have just finished sweeps, and now we just took the summer off.
I love that system.
How was Springsteen?
Springsteen was good. He just knows how to rock it. 3.5 hours, baby.
3.5 hours. Yep. That sounds like a Batman movie.
That's right. That's just what's amazing is it's shorter. The Batman movie seems so long, but a Springsteen concert is longer, and yet it keeps you on your toes the entire time.
There's a paper to be written about this somewhere.
Probably.
Well, last week, we were not here to talk about the new Divergent series, Allegiant. We were not here to talk about Eye in the Sky, starring Helen Mirren and Alan Rickman's last feature film on screen. So if we have time today, we'll get to those.
Absolutely.
But, you know, if we don't, it happens.
Yeah.
However, a big movie was released this week, Hannah. Batman versus Superman.
Oh, is that this week?
Dawn of Justice. And Dawn of Justice is, you have to be a comic book person to realize what that means.
They're what does starting, it mean?
So Warner Brothers, who owns this property, is using the DC Comics characters. And they're starting and their own Avengers. So Marvel has their own movies like Iron Man, Captain America, and then they put them all together in the Avengers. Well, DC Comics is Batman and Superman, and now they're going to put them all together in what's going to become the Justice League.
Like the cartoon from Saturday mornings from way back when.
From way back when.
When Wonder Woman was flying an invisible plane. I remember it well.
I must be more of a Jim and the Holograms guy.
Obviously.
So I saw Batman versus Superman, and, you know, I'm not raving about it. I don't really rave about superhero films. I'm 35 years old, so I guess I'm too old for that. But I don't hate it either. There's a lot of, it's not hate, but there's a lot of disappointment on the internets today about, people are disappointed, Hannah.
Well, but they were disappointed in Man of Steel, and I liked Man of Steel. So full disclosure, I've not seen Batman versus Superman yet. I'm going to go see it this weekend. But if it's the kind of thing where people who railed against Man of Steel are railing against this one, that doesn't mean I won't like it at all. In fact, it means that I may very well take something away from it that some of the critics just did not.
Well, I'm glad you bring up Man of Steel, because if you remember that from 2013, they introduced the new Superman starring your man, I guess.
Hot man.
At the end, in the climactic battle between Superman and General Zod, they tear up a city. Metropolis gets annihilated, and everyone in the audience is like, wow, you went above and beyond. You destroyed city blocks. I mean, thousands of people must be dead. And now we kind of know the reason why they did that. The first 20 minutes of Batman versus Superman is Bruce Wayne starring as Ben Affleck.
Yes.
A lot of people had their opinions about that, and I think he does just fine. He is downtown when that happens, so they go back to the end of Man of Steel, and they pick up right there, and Bruce Wayne is watching his building, his employees, just get slaughtered by these out-of-towners, these Kryptonians, just trying to kill each other, and he gets really mad.
Okay.
So it makes it his destiny to take on Superman, who he thinks is operating above the law, and he should be held accountable, and he just produced over-the-top slaughter, and he needs to pay. And I don't really understand Bruce Wayne's motivations here. Yeah, he gets mad, but you gotta understand, you know, Superman kind of saved everybody else's life.
Yeah.
So he gets, there's so many scenes of Bruce Wayne just pouting and planning and like, oh, I'm going to get that guy. And it doesn't really coalesce.
Well, and Batman has certainly had his share of dark moments in movies where a lot of stuff gets destroyed and he's operating outside the law. So that's my biggest problem with this movie is I love things like the Avengers movies and Justice League in its in theory, because I like superheroes all kind of working together. They show off their individual quirks, but ultimately they're working for a common goal, and I like that. So I'm not so much looking forward to seeing Superman and Batman being at odds, because I prefer to see them all, like, can't we all just get along and work together for the common good?
You know, I did not like seeing them fight either. It takes a good 2 hours for them to get to the fight, and that's not a spoiler. It's in the title. They're gonna fight. And I did not like watching it. You know, they have a common enemy out there, and that's Lex Luthor, played by Jesse Eisenberg. And a lot of people had opinions when he was announced as Lex Luthor, tiny, tiny little Jesse Eisenberg. I, for one, think he did a good job. He knows he's the smartest guy in the room, and he is so pissed off that he's the guy. He didn't have any power to back it up. And I thought he played that very well. There are some people out there who think, he's no Heath Ledger. But hey, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
But I didn't. I'm tired. I'm not tired of superhero movies. You know what? I'm kind of tired of origin stories. This is another origin story.
Yeah.
We go back. You know how Bruce Wayne becomes Batman. His parents die. Guess what? We see it again. We see it again. They're walking down. They're coming out of the movie theaters, and mom and dad, pop, pop. And once again, like, I've seen this. It's clear as day from the Tim Burton 1989 movie Devil in the Dance of the Devil in Pale Moonlight. I mean, it's still there.
Well, and I liked that final Batman movie with Christian Bale. I remember feeling satisfied with how it ended. And so it's getting tough when all these movies reboot and try to restart from a certain point in time. When you've seen a whole bunch of them, then they don't all jive anymore, and the story loses a little something. But again, I'm going to go into it with an open mind. I think if you like that genre, it's definitely worth seeing. I think everybody's going to see it. Everybody's going to have their opinions. And in the end, it doesn't really matter that it's getting kind of panned by the critics, because people have been waiting for this movie, and Ben Affleck looks like he makes for a fine Batman, Bruce Wayne. And we all know that Henry Cavill, I think, is a fine Superman. So, again, I'm not going to go into it with very high expectations. I just hope I'm satisfactorily entertained.
You are spot on that everyone's going to go see it. This movie is critic-proof. It doesn't need critics to tell you if it's good or bad. You're not going to care, because you're going to go see it. And Ben Affleck said something very similar today. He said, this is an audience movie. It's not for critics. And I just want to say, well, that's actually not true. Every member of the audience is a critic, and they're going to walk out of the theater during the credits, and they're going to tell their friend what they thought. It was awesome. It sucked. And they're going to talk about it all the way on the way home, and they're going to text their friends what they thought of the movie, and they're going to tweet that they were there. No, a couple hundred critics every screening are criticizing this movie. Yes, it's critic proof. I mean, it's got 31% on the tomato meter.
That's harsh.
Legit critics didn't like it. But it's not, you know, everyone, you can still criticize it. There's no such thing as an audience movie. They're actually kind of telling us it's bad, if you say something like that.
Yeah, and so again, I think people who are interested in seeing it are definitely going to see it. Those who were never interested in seeing it, who don't care or understand the hype, they're not going to see it. And so I think that's what these movies always end up doing. They appeal to their base. The base will go regardless, and therefore it does its job.
Well, be prepared for, you know, you're used to the Avengers that they're fun. Robert Downey Jr. makes jokes, yes, and they laugh at Captain America because he's such a square. And even the original Batmans had their sense of wry humor, the Joker, the Riddler. Batman versus Superman is pretty serious. It's
dark. Is
there
no fun?
Batman is very serious. He is dry. He doesn't cry. Ben Affleck does not smile. Superman's a bit more loose, but he's still a Boy Scout. Yeah. Now, I actually liked, I'm not sure I liked how serious it was, but I like that he goes to the U.S. Capitol because there's a senator played by Holly Hunter who's calling a hearing saying, you know what, we have this Superman roaming out there doing whatever he wants to do, and he's accountable to nobody, no government, no leadership, nothing, and she wants to talk to him about it, and there are significant political questions raised, but it gets played. They don't finish it off. They don't tie the knot. It's a loose end there. And you don't walk out of the movie thinking, you know what, they examine the Superman issue from all sides, because they don't.
Right.
And Batman gets gets off scot-free here. You know, Batman's just as bad as Superman.
Batman's always been kind of worse to me, so it'll be interesting. But also, how is the new Wonder Woman?
I don't want to talk a lot about her, because I think she's going to have her own movie, and she comes in really late, there's a lot of secrecy about her. You might remember, she's Gal Gadot from the Fast and Furious franchise.
Oh, okay.
She was in 5 and 6, I believe. And she's, you know.
She hold her own?
She's good. There's a lot of innuendo, sometimes overt innuendo, of what's coming next in the Justice League, of future characters.
Okay.
You can see it. And like, oh, so that's where they're going to go. That's what they're going to do. And she's a big part of that. But she shows up. She dons the Wonder Woman attire and brings out the Wonder Woman weapons and holds her own. She holds her own with the men.
Good.
So good on her for that. So if you're going to see it, folks, watch out for the internet. There's a lot of surprises in this film. So beware of spoilers. There are a lot of surprises in this film. So just watch out.
All right.
Ah, man, I don't even want to start talking about the next film. The next wide release this week it's not an origin story. It's a dead on arrival, beat that horse really to death sequel, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2.
Woohoo!
Nia Vardalos, she still holds the record for the highest grossing romantic comedy of all time.
It's amazing when you realize that stat.
2002's My Big Fat Greek Wedding, I laughed hysterically. I fell out of my chair. It was so funny. I saw a sneak preview screening, and it was with a Greek Orthodox church audience who happened to show up. The priest was there and everything, and he was laughing. That movie came out of nowhere. It blindsided me. It was so funny, and it was so popular because families looked at it and like, oh, that's my family. We're so similar, and they identified with characters. Well, I'm Aunt Vula. Well, I'm Tula. Well, I'm Eon Miller, the white man. And now, you know, you haven't seen Nia Vardalos for a while, and she's like, okay, it's time for a sequel. 14 years later, Hannah, number 2.
Well, and I missed the screening of that one, so I did send a coworker, Lauren, on my behalf, who raved about the first one. It's one of her favorite movies of all time. And so she and her sister went, and I knew that their role was going to be to tell me like it is so that I'd be prepared to counterbalance your critique a little bit. And I'll tell you what they said. They said, it's not fine art, it's not going to win any Oscars, but it was fun and funny. And so that's from people who have watched the original over and over and over again over the years. Absolutely loved it and got enough out of the sequel to make it worth their while.
I'm shocked that someone says it's fun. I didn't have any fun. I laughed a couple times because it is a comedy, but it wasn't. I was almost hurting. I was sad. I was disappointed. 14 years ago, are you the same person you were in 2002? Have you changed at all?
A little bit.
I was just finishing up college, and now I've been all over the world and have a wife and kid. I've changed. Nobody in my big fat Greek wedding has changed a bit. The old man is still saying, you give me words. Any word I tell you, it's from Greek. And he still carries around his bottle of Windex. Aunt Vula still says, I have this mole and this thin and over here. No, nothing. It's the same jokes, Hannah.
It is. It's just revisiting that family. And the family has not changed. And that's why it seems more to me like one of those movies you'd catch it on a plane or you'd catch it on demand or you'd rent it from Redbox eventually. So I'm not saying that anyone should necessarily rush out and see it. But if they really love the original, if they're very excited to just revisit these characters, it's never going to be as good as the first one, because what made the first one so great was the fact it was so unexpected. And these characters were so original at the time. It was this breath of fresh air. It was funny. You hadn't seen it before. So yes, you're always going to be losing that factor. You have seen it before, but it's just a continuation. And you are just going back to a family reunion where these people haven't changed all that much. And you have this opportunity to see them again. And if you had a really good time at dinner with them 15 years ago, it's kind of fun to just revisit and see him again.
It is a family reunion, but it's the family reunion where your uncle says, hey, have you heard this one yet? And he's like, yes, uncle, I heard it 14 years ago when you told me the first time. And
but you can relate.
And the first movie worked because it was about culture shock. You've got the family who puts the Greek in Greek American, and you got the American trying to integrate in there. And and how that and how he fails to do it, and how they it takes work for them to accept him as one of their own. Now there is no more culture shock. He's one of them now, and the culture shock is gone. There's no more jokes about that. Now Tula has become her father. She has a 17-year-old daughter now, looking to go off to college, and I understand where she's coming from. She wants to go far, far away. She's embarrassed. She's tired of her family and how nosy and how pushy they are, and you are on her side. These guys are way in your business. And Tula probably gets the best line of the movie, and it's the same line from the first movie, and she gets her father's line. Why you want to leave me? I laughed really hard at that one. I did.
Well, so go to a matinee if you're interested in seeing it, because I don't think you have anything to really lose if you enjoyed the first one. And I just think there aren't that many decent comedies out there. There's certainly, I can't think of anything comedy-wise that's for a family that's better.
Comedy? Well, there, anything
a family
is better.
Comedy.
If what there else? Is a comedy still in theaters, it's got to be better than
but
this
what?
One.
That's just it. I don't think there really is anything. And so I think for those who are looking for just a family-friendly comedy, this is pretty much the only thing that's out there right now for them, other than, you know, if they've already seen Zootopia.
Yeah, I'm no Zootopia fan, action. And I'd say get your butts to Zootopia over this thing.
I would certainly say that, but I think if you're looking for a live-action comedy, this is pretty much it. And so
and that's
I think
no excuse to go waste money and see it. Go outside and enjoy the springtime.
That's true, too. But if you're going to go see a movie and you're looking for just a two-hour escape, that's just a...
Not even.
An entertaining...
We're talking 80 minutes here.
An hour and a half escape. Then, and if Superman versus Batman or Batman versus Superman is just not your speed, then, you know, I wouldn't discount it entirely. So the people who saw it on my behalf thoroughly enjoyed it for what it was. So
well, it has a lower, much lower rating than 31% on the tomato meter.
is it really
a lot
lower
of people
than
don't
31%?
Like this movie.
Yeah. That's harsh, but you know
if more
do?
People lived in urban areas with these specialty art house theaters that we enjoy in Washington, D.C., I would rather them go see this next movie we're going to talk about rather than the movie they're forced to go see just because it's the only theater in town. This one is called Marguerite. It's a French film. Yes, subtitles, but half of it's funny. It's a comedy drama.
Yeah, dramedy.
And it was nominated for 16 Césars. That's the French Oscars. And it just won 7, including Best Actress, Best Costumes, Best Production Design. It looks really good. And you actually did get a chance to see Marguerite. And I know you have a nice little backstory about who called your attention to it. So take us through Marguerite.
That's right. Well, I did watch it all the way through to the end, so I thought you should be proud of me for that, because it is a movie with subtitles, and it's what I would call a solid choice for independent foreign movie buffs, but it's a great choice if you happen to also be an opera buff. So if you know opera, then you're going to get more out of this, which brings me to the story, backstory, which is that my parents saw this and had brought it to my attention a while back because they had seen it in a preview screening. And they really thoroughly enjoyed it, and they definitely know their opera. And so luckily, after I watched it and just simply told them that it was kind of weird, they called at midnight to explain to me what I was missing from this movie. And it put it into a different context that did help me appreciate it more. And so basically, it's really about this woman, Marguerite Dumont. She's a wealthy woman in Paris in France, in the 1920s, she's got a passion for singing. The only problem is that her voice stinks and nobody will tell her. And so most of the singing that she does is for like these private audiences at their clubs because they want her money. And she's this patron of the arts. And so she just continues for years on end, just basically singing badly for people. And this whole cast of characters, bizarre characters, comes into play in this movie. And somehow she ends up getting a teacher who's going to help her learn to sing better before she has a major public recital. And so the comedy is really all about, and the tragedy, about how far people will or won't go to really give her reality checks so that she doesn't embarrass herself in public. And it's structured like an opera. So it's like a 5-act opera. And the music that comes into play has certain subtext to it. So if you know opera, if you know arias, you'll understand, as I was told, that the first aria that she performs in this movie is probably one of the most difficult arias to sing. And so the fact that she would start with something so difficult and be so bad at it kind of set the tone for the movie. So, yeah, I mean, it's not for the mainstream audience. So if you're looking to go see My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 no matter what and you're going to think it's hysterical, I don't think you're necessarily going to like this movie. If you're an indie foreign movie buff, I think you definitely will.
I think if certain filmgoers gave independent and subtitled cinema a chance, far more would enjoy Marguerite than My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. The character of Marguerite Dumont is so much more faceted and deep and interesting than anything you'll see in The Greek Wedding. She's fun to watch. She's a joy. I don't know a lot about opera, and I don't know, you know, what she's singing here, what she's singing there, what it means, but I did recognize that first one, when she gets up at the beginning of the film and she starts singing Queen of the Night from Mozart's The Magic Flute. And that, I only know it because I've seen Amadeus so many times. That is an aria you do not want to mess with.
Yeah.
And she does it with such confidence and such, she's got her arms on her chest and she just belts it out. And man, it is tough to listen to. Even in, like, you think it's a comedy, you think you're supposed to laugh, and it is tough to listen to. It actually makes it an awkward watch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, there's a lot of crowd in her house watching her sing. And then that's when it all takes off. There's a critic there, and he wants to use Marguerite kind of for his own end, kind of to make her his patron. So he writes a rave review. He says she was exercising her demons. You know, it's a very sly, subtle,
very unique voice.
You know, if you read it in Marguerite's point of view, it's a rave. But if you read it in another point of view, he's actually slamming her. And his best buddy there is an anarchist, and he wants to use her to tear down the bourgeoisie and the establishment. It's really funny how he tries to do that. I didn't catch it at first, actually, until you said your parents pointed it out. It's structured like an opera, and the ending, it borders on tragedy, and I'm not going to give that away, but I wondered, and I want your opinion on this, is Marguerite crazy?
I don't know. They certainly play her as delusional, but they also, she's a very sympathetic character.
She is.
And I think that was the most interesting thing to me, and I can see why she would be given such kudos for her acting, because it cannot be easy to sing this really difficult stuff badly, and as badly as she does, because you still have to, you have to know the music and then fail miserably at performing it. And she is so passionate, and so you can't help but root for her, and you're totally rooting for her throughout this movie. But it is very difficult to know what's real in her mind and what's not, and what other people are hearing, and whether she's hearing herself the same way other people are hearing her.
I want to give the director here a lot of credit. His name is Xavier Giannoli. It took him a while to get this made. He didn't have the financing, and he actually made this on a very limited budget. But when you look at her house in Paris in the 1920s, he was able to pull this all together, and it is a gorgeous-looking movie. I'm really, really impressed. And unfortunately, I don't like seeing movies kind of I've already seen but made through another lens. We're going to see a version of Marguerite Dumont again, and it's going to advance about 20 years into the 1940s, and it's going to be based on the real person, Florence Foster Jenkins. We're going to see Meryl Streep take on this role in Carnegie Hall, and it's actually based more on the true story. Marguerite is much more fictionalized, but I'm already dreading watching it. I don't want to see it again.
See, I'm the opposite, because, first of all, Meryl Streep is so incredibly talented, and I do see her pulling this off, and it's going to have Hugh Grant. And so it's going to be this sort of American-British take. So it's going to be in English. And, it is based – both stories are based loosely on this Florence Foster Jenkins, and she was a New York heiress who became an opera singer who sang badly. And so I do think that that next movie with Meryl Streep and Hugh Grant could very well prove rather popular, and it will cross that mainstream arty divide way more than this movie ever will. So I think people, if you want to sound really smart, I think the best thing you can do is you go see this movie, Marguerite, And then when that other one comes out, you're like, oh, well, I saw the French version of, you know, a very similar story
and
that
the
came out
reference.
First.
You know, when Gianoli did this in Marguerite Dumont,
yes,
you know,
yes.
He did this, but this did that.
I think that it'll give you a lot of cred. It'll give people a lot of cred with the arty crowd when that Meryl Streep movie comes out. And I would not be at all surprised if Meryl Streep gets, gets just a lot of awards.
Well, it's Meryl
attention.
Streep. Come on.
It's Meryl Streep, so she automatically does. But
she'll sneeze and win best sneeze.
I can't imagine that it. Certainly, my hope is that it will be better than the one in The Flash.
Ricky and the Flash. That'd be hard because that was a good movie.
See, so I'm guessing that that next Florence Foster Jenkins movie that she's in will be better than Ricky and the Flash. In which case, I will be one happy camper.
All right, well, that's playing at your local art house theater. And there's two others releasing this week that I got a chance to see. One was submitted as Argentina's nominee as Best Foreign Film. It didn't make the shortlist, and I can see why. It wasn't one of the top five, but it's called The Clan. And it's very, you have to know to really get the, for Marguerite, you need to know about opera to really appreciate the whole thing. To appreciate The Clan, you need to know about Argentinian history, especially.
I'm out.
You know, they used to be in the late 70s, early 80s, they were a military dictatorship, and 30,000 people disappeared. That's where you got the term to disappear someone, because
right.
Any alleged political opponent just got taken off the street. You never saw them again. So that is the backdrop to The Clan, which someone said it is Argentina's version of the O.J. Simpson trial, that kind of like national nightmare that still resonates. People still talk about the Puccio family from Argentina. A very well-respected family led by this strong, iron-willed patriarch. Three sons, two daughters, helped him with their homework at night, family man. But at night, he would also kidnap his friends for ransom. And it shows you he did this with full complicity and knowledge of the police. They let him do it because that's what you could do in Argentina back then. Only then, later, when they transitioned to democracy, did the rug kind of get pulled out from under him and this all came to light. So it's a thriller. It's not an action thriller. It's not a lot of action, but it's showing you this family living a normal life when you know just off room and you can hear the moans and the wailing of kidnap victims. It's almost absurd. There's a lot of debate in Argentina still. Who knew what in that household? Was the wife complicit? Did the daughters know? You know, and I'm not going to give away now what happened. There's, you know, they obviously get caught, but I'm not going to tell you who's where now or who's alive, who's dead. That's for you to find out, but another good foreign film playing at your local art house theater. Does that sound appealing in the least, Hannah?
In the least.
Oh!
It sounds like the least appealing of all the movies that we've discussed so far.
Come on.
Sadly, I'm sorry, but that sounds like it just would have absolutely nothing to draw me into the theater. I would just say, you know, hey, certainly it doesn't sound like something, if I had to choose between Marguerite and this Clan movie, I certainly would encourage most people to stick with Marguerite.
I would actually pick Marguerite over the Clan. All right, I'm going to hit you with another one, and I'm already going to give it away. It's my first and only 4-star review this year. Therefore, it is my current favorite movie of the year so far. And it's very small. It is very indie. It's called Krisha. And it's made by a 25-year-old first-time feature film director. And it's actually very biographical. He cast his aunt as Krisha. He cast himself as her son. His mom's in the movie playing his mom. His grandma's in the movie.
It's like My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Has Alzheimer's. And she has Alzheimer's in the movie. And he shot it in his mom's house.
Uh-huh.
So it's very biographical. It's about a long-absent black sheep family member, Krisha. She's about 65 years old, and she comes in for Thanksgiving, and she wants to make amends. You get the feeling she's in a 12-step program, and she's going to make Thanksgiving dinner. Everyone will have a big hug and a cry, and they'll move on. But that's not what happens. Krisha is a tragic character, and she has a habit of self-sabotaging, and it's very sad. But it's such a poignant watch, and it nailed me to the couch, Hannah.
I just, another sad indie. I just can't do it. I can't do it.
This one, you've seen the story, you've seen it before. It's a formula. Family member comes in, have problems, let's work through it. But you've never seen it this way. I've never seen it this way. It's completely in English.
Okay.
The camera work is fascinating because it's actually showing you in the addled brain of an addict. Ambient background noise is a lot sharper, and conversations right here are dimmer. And the camera swerves around the kitchen island, and it's very disorienting, and it's fascinating. I know no one's going to see this movie. It is small. You have to try to find it. But I think you're going to see the lead actress pop up. Her name's going to pop up in awards season. Her name is Kreisha Fairchild. She's a voiceover actress, a retired voiceover actress, and she's about to catapult. You're going to see her again.
Okay, I will keep an eye out for her. And when those top 10 lists for next year, for 2016, are revealed, I will try not to be surprised when that is on your list and I still will not have seen it.
I guarantee you. I know you're not going to see this movie. I know you're not going to see this movie, and that's okay. I just want you and people out there to know there is this movie. It is small. It is hard to find. But if you appreciate movies out of nowhere, find this film.
And I can appreciate your appreciation for it. And so I would indeed hope that anyone who does generally like those little gems that you find, that they go and seek this one out too. I will just sort of take your word for it.
Well, let's talk about another little gem that we have seen, and that's Eye in the Sky. And I drug you. You did not want to go to the movies last night. That night, I drug you to that movie. And
it was snowing.
It was far away. It was snowing. It was cold, and I said, Hannah, get in the car. We're going to see this movie.
It was in a weird part of town.
And what happened?
I liked it. So, Eye in the Sky with Helen Mirren. First of all, how can you not like a Helen Mirren movie? And so, it's about drone warfare. And I've got to admit, it was better than I would have expected. I think it's very timely. I think if you're talking about cases with the war on terror and things like that, this movie plays up the moral, political, military dilemmas that go into drone warfare in a way that no other movie has really been able to capture. I saw a documentary at the AFI Film Fest last year that was, I think it was called Drones, simply Drones, and it was about the war, using drones for warfare and how pilots aren't really necessarily seeing their targets. And it's also, you're so removed from the carnage and what's going on in the ground. But that movie failed to really sway me in any way. And it was a documentary. This movie is a drama, just nails the dilemmas that are going on. And there's a pilot, an American pilot who, Aaron Paul. So he is the person who sort of, at the controls of this drone from his little warehouse in Nevada somewhere, and he is instructed by a colonel played by Helen Mirren to attack this safe house, basically where a known terrorist is holding a meeting and plotting suicide attacks on these folks in Pakistan. Right? Is it Pakistan? Kenya. And so it's just a fascinating watch, and I think anybody who maybe was really disappointed by things like Whiskey Tango Foxtrot should go see this one, because it's a really, really well-acted, strong narrative, and definitely worth seeking out.
It does not get more timely than Eye in the Sky. I expect tomorrow morning in my newspaper to see drone strike killed 19, in whatever country, because every day you see that. Drone strikes are going after the terrorist target. And you see it from all these different facets. Helen Mirren in Surrey. The general in London, Alan Rickman, is trying to convince these, they're not cowardly politicians, because they're the ones who have to answer tomorrow about collateral damage. And collateral damage is the big theme of this movie. What is acceptable? To take out these guys who are, they're in a house arming themselves with suicide vests, and they're about to walk out to a market. They're probably going to kill like 80 people. Is it okay to kill those suicide bombers and one little innocent girl to save those 80 people? And this movie's about people wrestling with that very question. It's a tough, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't have a clue.
And I don't think it answers it. It's very compelling how they play this out. And it really does all go down to what's the value of one human life versus multitudes of people. and the difficult choices that are being made in the back rooms and among politicians and military, and that face off between military personnel with a mission to accomplish and politicians who aren't on the front lines, who are trying to direct the decision making, and the lawyers who weigh in on what's legal and what's not legal. And there's a lot of murky areas. The best, also one of the great things about this movie is that opportunity to see one of Alan Rickman's, really his last performance. And you just realize, you know, what a loss he is, because the guy was so versatile and he's so fun to watch even in this role.
Yeah, that character took on a different weight in the movie than he would have if Rickman was still alive.
Yes.
You know, the biggest conflict in the movie is actually not terrorist versus drone or terrorist versus military. It's military versus politician. Mm-hmm. They're verbally persuading and pulling and pushing to get permission to fire. And this movie will make you sweat. Like, if you're really into this movie, you're not going to move. You're going to be glued to the screen. You know? And if you know anything about drone warfare, there's a lot of mistakes. There's a lot of little details that are wrong. You know, you're looking at the screen and you're just watching this girl, this little innocent girl, and it looks like the camera's on a tripod. Well, drones orbit. They're planes. So half the time you'd be looking at the girl's back. We don't, you know, they don't do that.
A dramatic license, you know. You do what you got to do to tell a story, but that could also be why the drone documentary just really didn't take off, as it was kind of flat and didn't have that, you never cared so much about people. And they do a really good job of just kind of making you care about what happens, not only to the little girl, but to the drone pilot and his sort of co-pilot, who are wrestling with seeing this child playing there and do you follow orders or do you resist? Do you challenge? And everybody wants to refer up. That's the big thing they always talk about, is got to refer up for this decision. And, you know, nobody wants to take responsibility because there's no good answer. And I think that's what makes this movie really good, is that it acknowledges that.
There's a little cross-cultural bias, I think. It is an American pilot, but it's a British command.
Yes.
And when they refer up, every time they hit an American in charge, they're like, why are you even calling me? Kill him. Just pull the trigger and kill him. It's the British politicians who are like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, but it's the American pilot who's also trying to stop, you know, doesn't really want to launch the attack. So I think it kind of, there's plenty to go around in terms of the potential blame game, but also it makes some very good points, and you wrestle with the questions. And so I think it's one of those thought-provoking movies that people really kind of come out and go, wow, yeah, I don't really know what's the right thing to do in that situation.
You know, you were just talking about if a family wanted to go out to the theaters and just have family time at the theaters. I know they won't, but they would get so much more out of Eye in the Sky. And you could take a family to that. There's nothing really objectionable in there.
Yeah.
They would get so much more out of that than My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Although, surprisingly, I think it might be rated R. And I think that's a shame, because I do think that it's a really good movie for any teenager who's learning about current events to go and see.
Yeah, that's one of those R, but, and I think I know why it's R, but it's one of those where it doesn't matter. You need to go see it.
Yeah, and there's nothing overtly, you know, bad for kids. In fact, yeah, I think anyone over 12 really.
It's R because there's some carnage in it.
Yeah, and there's some cursing.
There's probably, you know, they're staring at the screen, but they're only cursing at a screen.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't think that should actually detract anyone from seeing it. And I certainly think that it's less violent ultimately than a Batman versus Superman movie that's PG-13. So I would hope that this is one that I would hope that anyone who does like to sit around the table and talk politics at night or something might consider doing as a family outing and having a nice little chat about it.
Absolutely. I'm 100% on board with that.
Yeah.
To bring it full circle, we talked about the critic proof Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice, which is, you know, not going to be your favorite superhero movie, but it's probably not going to be the worst. And it's launching a new dynasty. It's up to you how you feel about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not fun.
All right. Well, I'll give my feedback next week. So we'll see, again, going into it with an open mind.
We talked about My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, which is a big fat waste of time and an unneeded sequel because you've already seen it because you saw the first movie.
Yeah, so I would say you got to see the first one if you're going to see the second one. And if you really, 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 really love the first one and you're really, really, really looking forward to seeing these people again, then you might want to go see it. Otherwise, yeah, I wouldn't give it a rave must see.
We talked about Marguerite, a film the French movie-going public loved, about a wonderful character who is fascinating to watch in an interesting situation. I urge people to go see it, certainly.
I would say, yeah, if you're, again, into foreign indie films and you like opera, then it's definitely one that you should seek out. Also, just be aware, I think, that you kind of got to stick with it through the first half. The first half is a little slower than the second half. And so once you're fully invested and used to the subtitles, it picks up. But it was a little difficult to really get fully into it until about midway through.
You know, people would expect me to jump in here right now and disagree with you, because that's usually what I do. But no, you're spot on. Second half is so much better than first half.
Did I get that on tape?
I brought up the Clan. You know, if you know your Argentine history, definitely go if you're familiar with this story. Or if you just like to know that this movie just broke box office records in Argentina. Everybody in that country went to see this movie because they're so familiar with it. That's an option. Or there's one I would really urge you to see, which I don't know how you'll see it unless you live in a major city right now, which is Creesha. You're going to hear about it again come awards time. Just know you can see it now in the theaters.
Or wait for and put it in your Netflix queue.
However you see it, I urge you to see this movie. Even Netflix is just fine. Finally, we caught up with a movie that opened last week, Eye in the Sky, a current headlines thriller suspense that really knocked me off my toes.
I would say that's the best of the bunch.
Really?
Eye in the Sky. I would say if you missed that one, it's still out there. It's only been out for a week. If you're just looking for just a good, solid, again, it crosses that mainstream arty divide, I think it's worth seeking out.
All right. Well, actually, I like that you said that. I'm glad you liked Eye in the Sky so much, because yeah. about how much work I did to get you there.
That's right. It paid off.
To preview next week, we're going to talk about, I think, the unofficial sequel to Dazed and Confused. It's called Everybody Wants Some, two exclamation points.
I think that's Everybody Wants Some, !!
That's right. We're going to talk about a movie starring Ethan Hawke as Chet Baker, Born to be Blue. And I think there's one or two others. I just can't remember them offhand.
Midnight Special, is that next week or is that
still that's one further? I don't get to see, though, because I'm playing Mr. Mom that night.
Yeah, so for a change, I might actually see one more movie than you, which is good.
But don't worry, I'll probably have one or two that are like, Hannah, I just saw this.
That's right.
All right, so thank you for listening to The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell from charliejewell.com. With me, as always, is my lovely host, Hannah Buchdahl, chickflix.net.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. And everyone, thank you for listening.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.